how do I be more human? And by more human, I mean actually that tapping into not what addicts my biology or what distracts my attention, but what makes me deeply fulfilled and connected and joyful as a human being.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Xavier Helgeson. He's the co-founder of Enduring Ventures, a long-term holding company. We talk about holding companies, the publishing industry, capital allocation, focus, reinventing ourselves, building things that last, parenting, and more. Please enjoy.
What was the impetus and the goal for starting Enduring?
You know, the impetus, there were a few parts of it, but I would say one big part was I was an unemployed 40-year-old with the marketable skills after I had transitioned voluntarily, I will say, but I had transitioned out of being a startup CEO, and I had still helped the company for a year or two after that. But I was, you know, I still had to work for a living. I hadn't had that big exit where you just can do whatever you want. And so I really didn't want to get a normal job. I really didn't want to start a new startup from zero and go through another 10 years of grind. And so I was looking for something that would provide enough cash flow for me to live a, you know, sort of reasonable life, but also would be something ambitious enough that I could build it into something as big as I wanted to build it without any obvious constraints on its growth or its market. And so I can't even remember where I got down this rabbit hole. I think it was part of it was I'd heard this Buffett quote one time where he said I could make 50% a year off a small amount of money. Like his big problem is he has too much money to deploy, and so he doesn't have the opportunities he used to. And one had really stuck with me, and I thought, okay, well, there's a real advantage to being small in capital allocation. And then there was also Sieba had, my business partner, had gone ahead of me down the rabbit hole of business acquisition, how you finance it and how you use the SBA and how search funds work and all these sort of things. And I found that very interesting because I'd never gone down that rabbit hole prior to us getting interested in this. I'd been on the buy and sell side of transactions, so I knew what it looked like, but I hadn't contemplated that I would just buy a business for my own purposes.
For most of your career, you were a founder and entrepreneur of a single company at a time, more or less. Now you've acquired over 20 businesses. Why make the switch from going really deep on a single business versus stretching yourself across 20 plus businesses at once? What are the advantages and maybe disadvantages of that?
Well, it's funny. I actually have way more personal freedom and flexibility with 20 rather than one. And so what I find is like when you start a business, you often make yourself the center of it because you're ambitious, you're competent, you have a vision for it, you see where it's going to go. And so like all you become Grand Central Station, all the trains go through you and all the investors go through you, all the stakeholders, the press goes through you, the team goes through you, everybody's looking at you. Ever like be a leader for an organization. And so it becomes, you have to be all in on that one thing. And I think because I didn't have like a capital allocator background, I actually was all in on stuff that was like pretty risky, whether it would ever turn out into financial, you know, a huge financial home run. Like the stuff I was doing was working sometimes and it was growing, but of course you also have to take in investors. So you also have to clear a certain amount of value created to, you know, to really have your own big exit. And so it's just a general thing of having all your eggs in one basket, no matter how attractive that basket may look, is a risk profile I didn't want for myself anymore. And I appreciated the fact that my investors all had their eggs in 20 different baskets, and that diversification was really valuable for them.
I think there's also an element of fun in terms of the complexity of the game that you're participating in. You tweeted relatively recently that although entrepreneurship is a complex game, it's a subset of a larger, more complex game, which is like, how do you generate higher returns on capital? now that you've been in both worlds, why is it that you think capital allocation is more of a complex and maybe a, more of a fun game for you personally?
Yeah, it's, you know, the whole world is playing it in one form or another, right? When you start a business, you don't think, well, I'm trying to allocate capital to produce higher than high risk adjusted returns. But that is actually what you're doing. Even if you start the business with a dollar and bootstrap it, you're just getting exceptionally high returns on that dollar economically. Maybe other non-economic reasons, but economically, everyone's a capital allocator. Every the guy running your local plumbing company is a capital allocator. He or she's deciding, do I buy a new truck? Do I hire that next plumber, or do I take more profits this year? And so when you look at things like in that tweet, I was referring specifically to technology, because I think a lot of technologists look at the world through the lens of software or hardware. And I come from a background as a technologist, so I know how to build both. So I know how to build hardware, I know how to build software. And the way I abstract it now is to say, well, that's a really valuable tool in the game of capital allocation. If I know how to build hardware for reasonable cost, and I know what it costs to make it, I know what impact that could have on the business model, and that's a super valuable tool that most capital allocators don't have. But at the end of the day, I'm still, if I build a useless piece of hardware, I may have done a great job of engineering that piece of hardware. I may have really be proud of what, you know, all the great ideas I have. I may have 10 patents on it, and no one cares because it was priced wrong, came out too late. You didn't get product market fit right, whatever that is. And so I just think, like, ultimately you, as a capital allocator, you can hire individuals to write software. You hire individuals to write hardware, hire individuals to manage businesses. And the great game of it all is how it all fits.
From what I can infer from the investments I know that you have made, borrowing from or building on your background in technology, is that you like businesses that have high gross margin, but are, I think you used the phrase, like, addicted to spending. And I think that's especially the case in venture capital, where they're forced into this position of kind of high growth. Although it could be potentially a sustainable business if not for that capital foundation that it was built off of. And I like the phrase you use for this. You call this austerity as a service when you're looking to acquire these businesses. While it's good for you and enduring, is this symptomatic of something wrong, more largely within VC? And if so, is it something to be fixed?
I think so. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this, and this is a podcast, so I'll just let it rip.
Yeah,
I think VC is overfunded by about 5x of what the capital actually should be allocated in the sector. I met a few great venture capitalists and absolutely world class at what they do. And there's probably like 50 to 100 in the whole world that are really like elite. And you should throw as much money at those people as you possibly can. They'll find great companies in good situations. And obviously the venture capital industry is much, much, much bigger than that. And so what tends to happen is, frankly, a lot of people who have never been exposed to financial discipline, they've never had to run a profitable company. They've never had to do a private equity transaction, for example, where they have to buy a profitable company and make it more profitable. They get into a situation where they're on the board of a company. And so they're pushing the company toward vanity metrics that they think will increase the value of their investment. Something like, if you told me you were going to sell me a $5 million ARR business, annual recurring revenue business, I would say, that's meaningless. I should maybe pay you a dollar for that. I should maybe pay you $20 million for it. I can't tell you anything about the value of the business based on its annual recurring revenue.
Right.
Nothing. Nothing. Does it cost you $10 million a year to get $5 million of annual recurring revenue? It's not a great business. But there's VCs every day who love that equation because they came in at $2 million ARR and they got it to $5 million ARR and the company burned $10 million to get there. and they, you know, they think that's a good story. And so I think Bill Gurley talks about this a lot too, where he's like, Silicon Valley like thinks its financial acumen is like an 8 or a 9, and really it's like a 2 or a 3, like most of it. And certainly, what I have seen is that, especially in the mania of 2021, there was absurd sums of capital thrown at any smart, competent person who had a relatively good idea. Mm-hmm. And they were highly encouraged to burn all that in the course of 18 to 24 months. And so the typical VC-backed business that we acquire has lost $10 million in the year before we acquire it. And we typically acquire it with a plan to lose $0 more after we take it over. So that's the sort of delta you're overcoming. I also think there's a lot of startups and VCs who are doing what I would call like plain house. It's like they're building something that looks like a company, but it's not actually a company. It has lots of people whose titles act like they are company titles. There's lots of meetings held. There's lots of strategies written. There's lots of documents produced, but there's not enough customers buying the thing for more than it costs to produce. And the only thing that is paying for all these, you know, $200,000 product managers is like VC dollars, and which are way more ephemeral than founders realize. They get dumped out of an airplane when there's a frenzy of tech speculation, and they're rarer than water in the desert when it's a when it's a time of austerity. And so, and very few founders who haven't been through multiple cycles know that that like feel that in their bones. Right. Talk to any founder who's been around since .com 1.0, they feel it in their bones if they're still in the game.
I'll shake off the shot at product managers, given my background. No, but it's very true. Are there alternative financing models that we should like, there's an abundance of financing, and there's a thousand different ways to finance something like this, but it seems like VC has become the de facto option for people who want to build a big business. Are there other models we should maybe that already are out there, but that we're unaware of, or that we should be, you know, piloting or testing?
Well, I think there's sort of, here's a way I could think of it. There's sort of like, let's call it $1 to $5 million that needs to be spent, seeing if an idea is going to work. And that sort of always needs to be spent. That's very, very, very unusual to get around it, unless it's a software pure play or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really the problem. That's actually classical venture capital. Classical venture capital was a $3 million Series A, which sounds almost comically small.
Right.
That was the model. $40, $50 million fund, $3 million Series A, a little bit to follow on in the B and the C.
That's a family really and friends prove, now.
Yeah, it's family and friends, right? And so incredible number of people have made more money now. And so that first, again, $1 to $5 million is easier to access than ever has been before. And if you can't access that, I don't even think it's like, some people say, well, I'm from, you know, the wrong background, or I didn't go to the good schools, or like I'm being discriminated against. And I would certainly say that that plays into it. It's easier for a white male to raise that money than it is for anyone else. But I've just seen enough people who are not that raise that first $1 to $5 million. If they have a somewhat decent idea, they're a somewhat competent, credible person, and they're taking a swing. As it's that next $50 million that I think that's where the discipline goes out the window, and companies get in this mindset of I need to raise $20, $30, $40 million to get from A to B or B to C. And that's where a lot of times they gloss over product market fit, they gloss over high marketing costs, they gloss over like that their product fundamentally isn't good enough, and they just spend all the money on vanity metric growth instead. Like if Allbirds had about 4 years ago had put $5 million into making a better shoe, they wouldn't be in the situation they're in now, where they took a mediocre shoe and tried to blow it, shoot it to the moon. By the way, your comment on product manager, I want to come back to that, because actually what that is the CEO delegating their responsibility for the product of their own company in a small startup. Hmm. If you're on Microsoft, great. Product manager is essentially like the CEO of that product, an essential function. If you have a product manager at a 10-person company, what's the CEO doing? Like, isn't that? So I think product managers are best CEOs because they actually have to be responsible for the product, which is the thing that actually decides if the business works or not. Like the financing doesn't, the marketing doesn't, the sales doesn't. It's the product that really makes most businesses work or not.
Right. So the theme there is that it's that focusing on growth at all costs and losing sight of the business fundamental, because there's that abundance of capital that you can get access to, which leads to this less discipline.
Yeah, you sort of like, it's kind of like taking steroids in the gym, right? Like it's like an easier way to get really ripped is just take steroids. But right. It actually is like not the optimal answer for what you're trying to go for.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah.
So at least in our corner of Twitter, or I think even more so in yours, because you're actually building a holding company. There's been this, obsession with buying cash flowing small businesses and building holding companies over the last couple of years, I think in particular, and for good reason, that's a great type of business to build or to want to build. But as someone who's actually doing it, I'm curious what you think is misunderstood about the space, or maybe why isn't this for everyone?
Yeah, well, I will give myself, I don't give myself a lot of credit, but one thing I will give myself credit for is seeing something early and then like stirring it up into a thing. And so like, I don't think I was solely responsible for this by any means, but I think Sieva and I going out there and talking like often and loudly about holding companies and cash flow and, you know, I had a few viral tweets around that sort of thing. I think it's a really good idea that was largely forgotten in the mania of playing in 21. And so even when we lost Enduring Ventures, we launched it in 19, I saw that mania freight train coming. And there's always something in the back of your mind as an entrepreneur, like, let me just build something the mania wants. And like, let me build a video conferencing tool or whatever else. And I'll be able to, an AI tool today, right? You could get a huge valuation. And that period of time, you can get secondaries. And I think we just said like, no, like we can tell this is going to be a bubble and then a bust. And we actually want to build something very durable. And the only, like the economic gravity of the world is cash flow. Like, does your bank account have more money in it or less money in it? And so for us, it was like the only like risk-adjusted return that made sense of what we wanted to do that we knew would work in good times and bad. So I think the biggest thing that people maybe don't get is like a holding company with three bad businesses in it is like still a bad holding company, right? It's like with three leaky buckets, the well is probably worse than one leaky bucket to fill. And so most holding companies have been built by a few great businesses. And then the difference is like 90% of people who own a few great businesses, probably 99%, either sell the business or they take the cash flow and they put it in their pocket. And it's the 1% who say, you know what, I'm going to not only have a great business here, I'm going to set up an engine to redeploy that capital at compounding rates of return. That's, if you look at the origin of Berkshire Hathaway, it's actually three failed businesses. None of the textile mill, the stamps, and a retail conglomerate, none of which are even around anymore. So the redeployment was actually the entire value creation of Berkshire. It was not the not just the buy and the hold.
Implicit within Enduring's name, and on the note of Munger and Buffett, who are kind of this embodiment of like long-term thinking and patience, is this idea of going the distance, doing this for decades, not years. Were those concepts that came naturally to you originally, like or early in your career, or were they things that you had to cultivate?
No, I would say I've always been oriented that way. And maybe it's just as a, like, as a builder, I don't think of like, I'm going to build this thing and sell it. And I think that that culture really got pushed hard by the VCs, to be honest. And I just didn't come up in that way. So I came up as like a builder who's just going to build something because it was cool and because it was like a thing that I thought should exist in the world. And so it's a much more values-driven approach than a transactional approach. And I would say there's everybody in the world who wants to make money off you, the VCs, the PE guys, the bankers, they all want to push transaction because transaction is what makes the money. Fees, carry is what makes the money. And so, you know, we had to invent essentially a new investment vehicle. We pieced together, I would say it's like, you know, 50% conglomerate, like 25% like private equity fund, you know, and like 25% like something entirely different, maybe like turnaround incubator and startup incubator. And we had to invent ways that we could fully align ourselves with our investors so that there's, for example, people pay investors and enduring ventures pay no fees and no carry. They don't pay any, we don't make any money on managing their money. They buy shares in the holding company, which are the exact same shares that I own and CA owns. And so they're literally along for the ride. We only sell shares when we need capital. And otherwise our goal is actually to reduce the outstanding share count, not grow it. Because now we all own more of the companies underneath. And so, yes, yeah, so it's a very different alignment model. It's harder to do, but it's one of the many surprises of doing this has been that people now call me, and we've just started a practice where we help people set up their own baby enduring ventures because
awesome.
There's so many cool things about it from a founder's perspective. You have founder remains in control. You're not forced into a sale. You're not forced into an IPO. You're not forced to pay dividends every quarter. Typical search fund model, the person that found the acquisition and leads the business only owns between 15 and 30% of the company, and they're basically forced to sell after 5 to 7 years. So for us, like, that's a great model to be an investor in. I don't want to be on the other side of that trade. I don't want to be the buyer and CEO who puts 5 years of my life into something. It just really started to crank, and now my investors say sell it off.
And you have this exceptional thread on the like 5 or 10 kind of structural decisions that make enduring what it is. So maybe I'll link to that in the show notes. I think that's incredibly valuable. There are a few of your tweets that I identified. I think most of them actually came from a recent thread you had on you turning, I believe, 44.
Another great thread.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And there were a few tweets I pulled out of that as well as others, I think. So this will be like a disparate section here, not a theme or a through line, but I really love these tweets and wanted you to elaborate on them. So the first one is that focus is the founder master skill above all others. And I don't think it's not surprising that focus is important. But I'm curious, what makes you say that focus is the single most important thing or the master skill?
Well, you know, if you think about anything in your life, right? Like, let's say I'm going to focus on getting in great shape. And every day when I wake up, that every hour I'm thinking about that. Hey, have I hit my workout goal today? Have I hit my steps goal? Have I hit my macros? Have I drank enough water? And I don't even have a girlfriend. Like I'm not doing a great job at work, but I am focused on looking great. I can almost guarantee you that a year after that, I will look great, right? I will be in fantastic shape. And what happens in so many startups is they take their eye off the ball. Like, they have this idea and it's a good one, right? Like, I'm going to help. Let's take the early days of Airbnb. I'm gonna let people rent out their spare room to guests who are traveling in town. Amazing idea. okay, the second you start saying, and maybe we should do this with hotels too, I'm going to go try to strike a partnership with Hilton, and maybe we should do this in Mexico. And like, maybe we should, you know, maybe we should actually own the apartments rather than rent them. And all those are like, in theory, like good expansions of the model, and they're good ideas, but you actually didn't nail the core thing. And so what the Airbnb did a great job of is they just said, no, this is our thing, and we're just going to live and breathe it. We're going to keep making it a little better, a little better, a little better. We're going to solve the myriad of problems that come up when you try to make it better. And this thing that people thought was like a weird niche, like sleep on an air mattress thing, actually became gigantic, because most like target markets are way bigger than you think they are. And if you actually get to the happy place where you saturate, let's say your target market is $100 million, which would be an absolutely tiny market. That's probably like the market for like rugby balls or something, right? And you saturate that market. You would just have to, if you actually got to 80% of that, A, you'd have an amazing business. You'd be doing 80 million in revenue. And B, you'd know a lot about making balls that you could probably adapt to a larger market like footballs, right? And so you're almost never constrained by your market, but you are entirely constrained by your focus, because you have limited time, limited money, limited resources. And so like, if you took a founder who was a master programmer, and you took a founder who was maniacally focused, and you told me I only had to invest in one, but like the focused one had literally no skills, I would say, like, I will invest in that incredibly focused person. Because they can hire those skills, but I cannot hire focus.
I think another important layer to this is that focus is a matter of perspective. So some people might look at what you're doing with Enduring and say, oh, isn't that antithetical to focus? He's got 20 businesses, but really your focus is a level of abstraction higher, which is identifying businesses and implementing teams that can run those businesses. So depends on the angle at which you're looking at it, but it's still focused nonetheless.
No, it is. Our like, it's actually really simple. Like if you look at what we have to do well, we have to buy or not buy particular companies. And then we have to make one key decision, which is who runs that business. And that's the two things that we have to do. And maybe we have to raise capital if we don't have enough capital, but like that's all other stuff. But so that's like the maniacal focus, right? Is making sure that every one of these businesses is run by the right person, and that when we buy anything new or allocate capital to anything, that we've done an absolutely exceptional job of analyzing risk and reward and mitigated downside, maximized upside.
Simple, but not easy. The second tweet that I really enjoyed, and I think I pulled an excerpt out of the larger tweet, so hopefully you still have the context on this one. But you said, to be great, work in the medium, not in the abstraction. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, I love this one so much. Someone taught this to me. This is not my original idea, but it's, if you think about what is the medium of business, it is rarely a spreadsheet. In fact, it's never a spreadsheet. It's, unless you're selling spreadsheets, it's not a spreadsheet. And so if your medium is, let's say consumer packaged good, I'm trying to sell a new sports beverage. Well, what's the medium that really works in? It's probably that drink case where there's 100 different drinks to choose from and someone's going to pick one of them. And so probably I need to spend a lot more time talking to people when they're at that drink case and figuring out what drink they choose and why they choose it, then going back to the lab and tweaking my recipe. Like that's the actual medium that the business is conducted in. And so I think about this a lot. And when you buy businesses, and that will applies to physical businesses, walking the floor with the owner is the medium. And so and all the analysis and the spreadsheets and the tax returns, illegal, that's all like to validate what a core conclusion is, which is either this is a great business and this is an honest, trustworthy owner who wants this business stewarded, or one of those is true or none of those is true, right? And so like, I think Brent Beeshore would probably say that like, the medium is like steak dinners with owners. That's how he often talks about it. And I really like lived this when I was doing energy in Africa work. So I've probably sat in over 1,000 African living rooms because that I made sure that I lived there for a time, but even when I didn't live there, that would be the one thing I'd insist on when I first hit the ground. I'd ask the team first day, I just want to sit with customers. Like, I'm going to pick customers on the map. So you don't even get to pick them for me, but I want to pick out customers on the map. I want to go sit in their living room and I want to ask them questions, and I'll bring them a cold drink or something to thank them for their time. Usually they were thrilled that I would come by. And I learned so much. Like, once you've done it enough times, you really get a sense for what people's lives are like. And I think that even a lot of people who've worked on issues of like building things for the developing world have not spent enough time in the medium, which is often the customer's home or the customer's field.
That's brilliant. I love that. And I love the application across, it's not just for a single business. It's also kind of, it's applicable to relationships. It's more broadly applicable. The next tweet, which was, I know for certain, a part of your 44th birthday thread, is don't be afraid to reinvent yourself. If it feels scary but important, you're doing it right. You will reinvent yourself multiple times. So just accept it and get on with it. Why is it that we're scared to reinvent ourselves in the first place?
Because we have to throw things away, right? We might have to throw away that expensive apartment in New York, right? We might have to throw away the 5-bedroom house full of stuff. We might have to throw away our networks in the sports drink industry because we're going to go do something completely different. We might have to leave behind our friends and our family in the U.S. because we're going to go live abroad and do something different. And so, you know, that feeling of loss and that feeling of insecurity, like, what if this doesn't work? Like, what am I going to do? You know, when I started Enduring Ventures, like, I had pretty high probability belief that it would work. But that didn't make it any less terrifying because I had to go to salary of zero, like, you know, companies owned of zero. And, you know, and just show up every day and make something happen.
How do you know when you're fleeing your old self or your current self versus reinventing yourself? And I think the distinction between the two might be subtle, but I think it's important to know when you're not running away from something versus running towards like a new identity. Do you have any heuristics for that?
Oh, that's really interesting. I think that I've seen people running away, and what running away can look like is like unfinished work, if that makes sense. Like, it's like, hey, I've actually gotten something from A to B and it really needs to get to C. You know, maybe a great example would be like raising kids, right? Like, if I leave when they're 5 years old and, you know, move to another country and leave them with their mom, well, that's not great, right? And many people would look at that in a negative light. And what that really is unfinished child rearing. But if I've gotten my kids out of the house successfully and I've gotten them to their age 18, probably the worst thing I could do is stay stuck in that exact pattern that I was in, you know, where my attention was on the kids, right? Because now my attention actually has to turn back to myself and my own desires, my own creativity. And so that would be a great time to reinvent oneself. Now that I don't have to live in the 4-bedroom house in the suburbs, I can live in the apartment in Paris and paint like I've always wanted to, right? Or whatever. And so I think that that's kind of how I look at it, is like, is the thing that you're in before you reinvent yourself, sometimes you'll be forced out. Sometimes you'll get fired or mm-hmm. you'll get broken up with, or something else will kind of push you and say, hey, this isn't working. Because rarely when you're like doing an amazing job at something you love, like, and you're just like thriving every day and you're happy, like rarely do you get fired in that situation, unless like you're not very self-aware. Like, it's usually like, actually you kind of needed to go. And like, it wasn't all working, but someone had to push. And you didn't end up leaving because you liked the paycheck, you liked the comfort, and that's what the company gave you a push. And I think that, like, so it can be like a forced reinvention or a not forced reinvention, but I would think it's like, am I like structurally capped in what I'm doing? Like, is what I'm doing actually like making me better every day? Am I growing? Am I being like, am I able to like do the things that I'm a genius at? Or like, you know, am I not? And if I'm not, then, you know, I have to like do the scary thing and say, hey, I bet on this thing. I bet on being a doctor my whole life. And it turns out I just don't like being a doctor anymore at 45. And so I've got to really check in with that and say, hey, do I actually need that doctor paycheck? No, I don't. I've just gotten really accustomed to having it. And I have to maybe kind of evaluate everything from scratch and say, what do I want? What do I need? And make different decisions.
Yeah. And the longer you go, the more inertia, the more you've kind of hardened that identity, the more difficult it is, and maybe more necessary to reinvent yourself. The last tweet is, your contribution to society is the sum of the benefits of the organizations you found, fund, or grow. I may be reading into this too much, but why the focus on organizations and not individuals or individual relationships? And maybe relationships are just a smaller example of organizations, but if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, well, I guess I was saying that in the context of when I think of society as a system, like you could go through your whole life being really nice to everybody and like really making their day brighter. And like that does have some, it has effect on individuals. It's probably marginal, the effect that has on society as a whole, right? So if I'm just trying to think of an example of a good, if I founded an organization that cleaned up all the rivers in North America, like Robert F. Kennedy did, right? Like that, whatever else he does in his life, like whatever else from this point on, like, he can directly point to, hey, I started this thing that didn't exist before, and that became a magnet for talent and money and activity. And that thing made a difference that is structural, it's tangible, it's not going back. And so I think people need to also think about the durability of the organizations they form. And that's where I'm spending a lot of time right now. So I'm thinking about, like, okay, how does Enduring Ventures, like, not only outlast me and Sieva, but like outlast like the next me and Sieva who take it over afterwards in the retirement home, right? And what good will it do? Like, what are things that we are not doing yet that we need to do to have it really be like a structural good in the world?
Starting with your founding of Better World Books 20-ish years ago, which became one of the leading online secondhand stores. You've spent, you know, like I said, 2 decades in publishing. You've kind of come full circle in the last few months with the acquisition of Scribe Media, which is one of the leading independent publishers. I want to ask a series of questions around publishing and the power of kind of media and audiences. I guess first is, what is it about publishing that has drawn you in and interested you over this long of a period of time?
Publishing is a sacred craft. I'm actually changing my title on the legal closing of Scribe, where my title in Enduring Ventures will be managing director and publisher. I will award myself the publisher title, which I'll have to earn by publishing stuff that I think matters and that I think stuff that is true, stuff that people want to read and try to democratize that. And so, you know, something happened in the past few years that just scared the crap out of me, which is that some publisher, I don't know which one it was, but they owned one of Roald Dahl's books. And they went in, I think he used the word fat, and they didn't like the word fat because that wasn't PC. So they went in and edited the book. No, No, you don't get that at the book. Like that, what a thought crime. And frankly, I've seen this kind of persecution of thought crime that really scares me, right? Where like there's now a consensus that certain things are okay to say and there's certain things not okay to say. And some of those things probably just shouldn't be said. We definitely, like anything, you have to draw a line somewhere. But we used to have the ACLU suing on behalf of the KKK to exercise their right for free speech. They were pro-KKK, not because they agreed with what they said, but because they believed they had the right to speak freely, as long as they protested peace. So that is probably a morally pure place for free speech, right? Than like, hey, I have to say, I can't say anything controversial because someone might say I said the wrong thing. And then they might try to play guilt by association and, you know, in some way take me down on the internet. So that's a long way to say, like, I think that traditional publishers, many of them have landed on the wrong side of our discussion around speech in society. And they also strike a really bad deal for the authors. Like they act like gatekeepers when they are no longer gatekeepers. Like you're a gatekeeper because you have a podcast that people actually listen to, right? That's a gatekeeper. So, you know, does Random House have a podcast? I don't know about it. If they do, maybe they do. But they will take 90% of the economics of a book and reserve all the rights to edit it, to screw it up in the future, to sell it for movie rights, even if the author doesn't agree with it, the treatment of it. They will keep all those rights to themselves because they used to be the keepers of distribution prior to the internet. And it's kind of shocking to me that that they've lasted and cemented their position as long as they have.
Have they been able to do that in the age of the internet?
You know, I think there's still they've kept a halo, right? There's still a prestige to my book that says Random House on it, right? And I think that what authors haven't fully appreciated is A, how much money they flush down the toilet that they would never do in any other medium. You wouldn't launch your podcast and say, hey, Random House, I'll give you 90% of my podcast if I can put your name on it. And they don't realize that there's an alternative because, frankly, the professionalism of the rebels, I would call it, in the publishing world has not always been there. It's been very small, very independent. And so there are some professional standards you need to hit as a publisher to make a world-class book, to get it on the bestseller lists, to get it in distribution everywhere, online and offline. But those can be hit. And what's cool about Scribd is it's published 2,000 books, including numerous bestsellers. So a lot of people don't know this, but David Goggins may have made more money on a single book than any other human in history. So he published his book with Scribd, the one that ended up selling over 5 million copies. And he owned 100% after cost of the royalties from that book. So he made, I think the number would be around 30 million, let's say, that he made from his book. Whereas if another author had sold 20 million copies through a traditional publisher, they would not have made as much as he made selling five. Because that publisher would have eaten the majority of it. And that person who sold 20 actually wouldn't have the rights to their own book when they're all done with it. They could still have that book edited on them 2 years later because something became unfashionable. And I think that's probably even more motivating to me as I have some book ideas myself I'm working on. Like, and I will be damned if anyone other than like my heirs has the right to screw up my book. And even then, I'm probably putting it in the trust that there's no way they can touch the book.
Scribd, having published 2,000-ish books, it makes sense why this was a desirable acquisition target. What were they doing that you're going to seek to improve upon? Or what are the levers that you need to pull to turn this business around?
Fewer, better books. So I would say at a certain point, Scribd went And there were certain people inside the company who essentially had this vision, we're going to be Ford's assembly line of books. And there was lots of hiring. Mm. There was lots of spending, very similar to some of the other companies we've seen with the spending addiction. There was lots of an idea of how do we publish 500 books a month? And I just don't think that's the right answer, to be honest. I think Scribe can eventually get back to a large scale, but even then, publishing is an artisan craft. It needs to be done with love, with care, mm-hmm. with very specific to the author's vision, a collaborative process, because typically people have a lot in their head that needs to actually be pulled out of them a bit. They have already mastered all this stuff that, you know, that they don't even find it interesting anymore, right? Whereas for most people, it's like the amount they know, like, yeah, Tim, like someone who's an expert on, like Tim Ferriss on health and wellness, right? Like he probably read a whole book on like vitamin C, right? And like most people would love to know like an iota of what he knows about vitamin C. But like for him, it's boring because he already knows that. So he's on to like whatever else he might be doing, you know, testing his own blood sugar level in real time or something, right? And so if anything, it's like just pulling that backwards and saying, okay, let's really deliver something that will be valuable and useful to a whole bunch of people and really focus on your audience rather than like your own curiosities, which are probably way beyond it.
One of the changes within media and marketing that has enabled this wave of independent publishing is individuals developing their own audience directly, such that they no longer need the publisher to help to distribute the book. It's not that you couldn't do that prior to 20 or 30 years ago. It's just become vastly easier, especially through social media. For you and, I guess first, where do you see the evolution of audience building and relationships with audiences going in the next decade or so in the future, and maybe specifically as it pertains to empowering more people to be able to publish their own books?
Well, it's a core part of the audience build stack. Like the single worst business decision you could make is build a huge Twitter following, a huge email list, a huge podcast, and then call up Random House and say, okay, I'd like to do a book. Please take 90% of it. Right. And so it's like, why on earth would you do that? It just makes no sense. And so part of what Scribe will be doing going forward is not only saying, hey, you can just pay us and you can just pay us for services and you own your book, you own your IP, you go do whatever you want with it. We'll still help you get it out in the world. We'll still help you market us, but just pure fee for service. We're also going to do JVs on books. And we're going to say, hey, we'll put our full weight behind this. Maybe we go 50-50 on the book with you and we're going to earn our 50, you know? And so we're going to earn our 50 by making sure that you're not out there on your own trying to get your book known. We actually are engaging a much wider network of people to make sure that people know about your book. And I think that's what authors really need. Like half the battle is writing a great book and the other half is getting anyone to care, because you have to get, like, in the long run, books are sold by word of mouth. There's no two ways about it. All the marketing in the world's not going to change that. But in the short run, you got to have a minimum amount of the target audience actually read your book, say, whoa, that's pretty good, and then start that word of mouth viral effect over time.
You and Sieva aren't unfamiliar when it comes to building audiences. Combined, you have a six-figure audience across platforms. And I imagine that's been pretty powerful for your business. I think I remember reading that at one point you opened up your calendar on Twitter, did 120 calls in, over the course of a couple of days, and it ultimately led to your biggest acquisition of last year. So you're very familiar with the power of audiences too. How do you see media as a lever for yourselves and for enduring, and how do you plan to continue to double down on or improve that?
It's really just you just can't underestimate it. I mean, it compounds in a way. You know, you look at like Buffett's Berkshire compounding cash flows. essentially like audience also compounds and it compounds in a really, really powerful and unexpected way. And the funny thing about it is it's not linear. I can't predict that my next big acquisition or my next CEO or my next business partner, whatever will come from, you know, from the audience, but my odds of them discovering us and putting their hand up and saying, we'd like to be a part of what you guys are doing is just infinitely greater because of the audiences. And so I think about, like, to me, the holy trinity here is really like Twitter/X. Like all the other stuff that tries to compete with that is just not even in the realm. And so who knows, maybe a dominant platform will emerge that's not that in the future, but I wouldn't bet on it. So I think it's that plus audio. Like, I say no to almost all press, and I will do audio long form because I don't have the work ethic that you have to actually host my own podcast. I'm not sure if anyone would care, but I certainly like to tell the story, and I like to find people who built their own audience that I can tell the story to, because I know it will come back in all sorts of interesting ways that I can't fully predict. And so I think there's incredible power to be in someone's ear for an hour or two, and that you can't easily replicate just from a tweet. So I sort of think of this holy nexus of like Twitter and podcast, and then I will say LinkedIn, which everyone makes fun of, but LinkedIn is also essentially a very important medium in the business, in many, many business communities, especially bigger business. And so everybody can make fun of it, but in terms of a place that is also critical for creators, it's very, very important. So when we think about that, and then you got to think about those channels and then say, okay, how do we convert those to more durable relationships? Twitter's actually pretty durable. Newsletters are also valuable. And so Sieva has done a great job building his newsletter. His newsletter is fantastic and has tens of thousands of subscribers. And so that's a tool in our tool chest now. We also have a newsletter for Enduring Ventures on our website. So we have ways as well that we can communicate to people direct rather than through those channels, which is also valuable.
Revisiting the topic of publishing and books for a second. For a couple of years now, I've been obsessed with this idea of, if we were inventing the book or an analog or a new instantiation of the idea of a book, a collection of ideas today in the internet and digital age, it would probably look dramatically different than it does now, because it's been around for forever. If you were to, and maybe Scribe might be thinking about this, if you were to reconceptualize or redesign a book that is more digital and internet oriented, so things like, it could have live content or be linked to other knowledge or be multiplayer, what are some of the ways you'd like to see the book evolve online with the power of the internet?
Well, you know, this may be the one place I'm really going to show my age, but like, I love a physical book. And so I actually buy every book in either audiobook or physical hardcover, physical paperback if I can't get the hardcover. But and I actually enjoy the analog ritual of sitting down and reading it. And so I think that like too much of our life gets spent on screens. So that's like, I've seen the textbook publishers, I've seen other people try to say, well, I'm going to make like a super ebook with digital content and everything else. And I actually think that probably the answer is more multi-channel. And so like when I put a book out, which I will, on building holding companies and capital allocation, like that's going to be a thick book. It's going to be a thick hardcover book. You will probably not want to listen to the audiobook in that, because you might fall asleep in the car. But like I should also be doing some YouTube videos taking specific concepts from it, knocking out 2 or 3 minute YouTube videos on taking apart specific topics, right? And trying to mash that all together is probably not nearly as useful as just saying, hey, you can find me on different channels. Maybe I'll post the videos on X instead. and say, hey, chapter three, I was talking about the difference between partnerships and corporations. Let me take you down a rabbit hole. And,
right.
And so that's where I think like the author's identity really on X, if X executes correctly, like the author's identity can live there over time. And you can go back like you did and read my old tweets and you have a pretty good idea what I think and what I stand for. And frankly, you in some ways have better recollection than I did because I haven't read those recently. And so I was like, wow, that's actually pretty smart things I said. I just need to go back and read my own tweets. And so I think that like, that's the kind of continuity that then a book can be a true hallmark that doesn't, like, I think a book's real power is it doesn't change and it's a statement in time and it's a physical object. And I don't think we need to go away from physical objects. I actually think more physical books, the better. And if someone prefers to go on Kindle and do some underlining and you know, see what other people underlined, like, I think that's really valuable. And I think it also can warp your experience of a read because I personally would not want my thoughts initially shaped by someone else's highlights and underlines. I would sort of like to make my own and then maybe I'll see if I miss something.
I have just a few remaining questions. So first, you've spent a lot of time in Africa. You built a business there. You're very bullish on the continent. And you said that the country that wins the 21st century will be the one to form the deepest links with Africa. You hope it'll be the US, understandably. What is it about the makeup or qualities of Africa that you think make it the future and make you so bullish on it?
Well, we have a population problem that people haven't fully grappled with. You know, so in many, including in China, the replacement rate is often as low as one person for every two adults. Many people just not having kids. Those that do don't have that many kids. When you have a declining population, all those great economic growth things, the youth and vigor of a youth boom, you know, great restaurants, great places to have a drink, new startups, new technologies. Those get replaced by the economic driver being we need to care for older people. Hmm. Huge growth of a medical system, growth of elder care homes, services for those elders. Essential for those elders, but not the things that are going to drive an economy forward. Actually, the things that make an economy grow much slower. And you see this play out in Japan, for example, which has gone through a full cycle of this. And so if you look at the Earth's population and where is the Earth's population growth happening? It is happening in Africa and India, primarily, a little bit in Latin America too, primarily Africa and India. And so Africa has the benefit of having 54 different countries, each of which has its own politics, its own international relationships, its own immigration policies. And so all of these countries can produce this incredible stream of young, ambitious talent that is motivated, that is educated. Africans are extremely motivated by education, extremely motivated. And if you look at the average educational attainment of an African in the US, I think it's higher than in any other immigration group. I could check this, but it's extremely high. Africans that make it to the US routinely get PhDs. And, you know, and then go on often to do deep science, entrepreneurship, et cetera. So I think that really this intersection of the US and Africa is this incredible partnership that could be formed, has been formed in bits and pieces, but hasn't been fully realized because they're a long distance from each other, where you have many entrepreneurial countries that have a very similar entrepreneurial culture to the US. Nigeria's culture is probably closer to the US's culture than any other two countries I've been to, honestly. Nigeria's population may hit over a billion, depending on where population growth goes. And so you have all these entrepreneurial people, hugely value education. Their infrastructure is crap right now. And so there's a huge need for local investment. There's a huge opportunity for emigration and immigration. There's huge business opportunities in both directions. I just think it's one of these things that Europe has traditionally had a stronger relationship with Africa, both from colonial history reasons, as well as just to geographic proximity, just closer on the same time zone. But Europe doesn't have the dynamism the U.S. does, doesn't have the economic heft the U.S. does. And so there really is a huge potential for the U.S. and Africa to team up, and the U.S. and India for that matter. But India being one country, that's sort of all in the hands of one individual with India, whereas Africa is as diverse as anywhere in the world in within those 54 countries.
That's an excellent overview. And I heard something similar from, I had a previous guest, I think it was, the episode was in the tens, but his name's Alpha Barry. He's starting a company called Temple Cities. It's like an autonomous city that he's building in West Africa. He's also from Africa himself, and the similar analysis of the situation and the opportunities there that I think many people aren't aware of. Shifting gears to the second to last question. You are a parent of two with a third on the way. I have a two-year-old, so I'm always interested in trying to find places to plug in parenting related questions. What have you learned about being a parent about yourself and maybe that you otherwise wouldn't have recognized?
What I learned about myself was that I had forgotten how to play and that I had forgotten how to make unstructured creative time for myself, and that those being a parent is a wonderful medium to bring those back. And the worst way you can be a parent is like have partial attention and like be on your phone and be like, hey, here's some crayons, kid, like knock yourself out. And like the best way you can be a parent is like, just do something absurd and ridiculous with the kids, just for the sake of creativity, the sake of fun. I remember one time we had this beloved French bulldog in the family, and we were trying to get take photocopies of his butt on like the copier scanner, and you're like holding him up there, and he's kicking and squirming, he doesn't want to do it. And it was just the most absurd thing, but like if you come to my house and you look on the fridge, there's like a photocopy of the bulldog's butt on the fridge, and it's like it's like those sort of things are the things that I really treasure in my relationship with the kids. And frankly, I've been thinking a lot about how do I double down on that, and how do I make like sure that like on Sundays, for example, that it's like a no screens for everyone time, and that there's lots of creative tools available to us so that we can tap back into our creativity, our humanity, and be less consumed with things that kind of take our attention, take our time, take our energy.
I love that. Play is absolutely lost as an adult. The final question that I ask everyone, to turn it back around on you, is what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with to think about or act on?
The question I would leave to you is one I'm spending more and more time with myself, which is how do I be more human? And by more human, I mean actually that tapping into not what addicts my biology or what distracts my attention, but like what is, what actually makes me happy as like what, not even happy is the right word, but what makes me deeply fulfilled and connected and joyful as a human being. And, some of the examples are like, you know, a sort of like deep relationships with close friends that you spend time building, and where you can sit around together and talk about nothing. Those are sort of things that like are more, those predate any of our technology, right? Waking up in the morning and watching the sunrise and staring at the sun a little bit, like that predates any of our technologies. Same as lying on your back and staring at the stars. Those are all essentially timeless human things. And I think we have this conceit that like our ancestors, especially our ancestors 10,000 years or 50,000 years back, were somehow more primitive than us. And in fact, actually, probably if anything, they were more engaged, more present, more creative, like more alive than we are today. And we sort of owe it to ourselves and our children to start to tap back into that.
Well, Xavier, or Francis Xavier Helgeson II, as you're trying to go by now.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your time. This was excellent. We covered so much territory. I really appreciate you doing an hour and a half with me.
Well, Spencer, thank you for doing the work. Like, I was so struck by how thoughtful your set of topics and questions were, and I just really appreciated that you did the work and came prepared. And it's a real pleasure to be on your podcast, and I think that now you also have a subscriber, at least one more.
Wow, I appreciate that. That means a lot. Thank you.